And
Recording in progress.
our two potential sharing tonight. One was the plan as advertised that we could talk about Kabbalah Shabbat, Kabbalah Shabbos, at the first of the Mizmorim with a little context. I had the opportunity, and I really think of it as an opportunity, not like when I have the opportunity to take the garbage out at home or for my mother, but I had the opportunity to write for Yeshiva University. They're putting out a publication about Tehillim, and so they don't have writings on every single one of the 150 chapters, but from their alumni, from their current students, from their faculty members, they asked people to contribute, and so I was able to contribute a few write-ups on a few of the various prakim in Sefer Tehillim, and the one that really caught my eye, that excited me the most, was that of Tehillim Tzadi Hey. Tzadi Hey, for those who don't recall, from the top of the Art Scroll Siddur, is Lehuna Ranana. And so, for the first time in my life, in a serious manner, I looked into the topic of Tehillim, of this chapter of Tehillim of Tzadi Hey, and trying to understand what's going on with that. And so, that's one topic we can look into, a little bit of textual analysis, something different than what we've done in the past. And so that's one option. The other option is something more similar to the flavor of our shirim, which would be talking about machlokes. It was not necessarily the plan for this evening, particularly when Rabbi Fox and I sent out a title. But given recent events, recent news stories, there's a lot of machlokes going on in the world right now, particularly in these United States. And having a conversation about machlokes in the current climate and in the parsha of Parshas Korach, it would not be, it would seem appropriate. And so I'm going to request that either over video or in the chat for people to vote to decide which one of these we want to do. Do we want to talk about Lekuna Ranana, or do we want to talk about Machlokas? I eagerly await the chat. Ooh, tough call. Come on. It could be Machloket instead of Machlokas if people prefer. All right. I think Enon, both because of his enthusiasm and because of his hilarious line, is going to be the deciding vote, and we are going to discuss Machloket or Machlokas. I can't guarantee that I'll be consistent. And so for all those who are in the chat, I'm going to drop our source sheet in. Ooh. Never mind, I keep forgetting that I'm not able to drop source sheets in. I got to do it differently. I'm going to attach our source sheet. I think every single time I give shear here, I forget that like it doesn't work easily for me. I think it's some setting, so... All right, we're doing a screen share. Yeah, we're going to do a screen share. I think that's the most realistic. So if anyone has any more comments, then they are more than welcome and encouraged to either share them by turning off their mic or by sending another chat. Clearly, we know how to do it now. So let's jump in. I'm going to share my screen. And we're going to talk about Machlokas. We're going to talk about Machloket and Machlokas, both connecting to our Parsha and in more recent happenings in the world. Okay. Now, when we think about Machlokas, obviously it's rampant in our Parsha. I don't even feel like I need to point that out. Machlokas is something that we're familiar with. We see it in every area, every context, and it's something that we often try to avoid. We often don't necessarily look to, but let's try and understand what it is about Machlokas that we don't like or that we try to avoid. And is it possible, maybe, that there's some element, some piece of Machlokas that might not be the worst thing in the entire world? And for that, just to set off the stage, Gemara Sanhedrin tells us that kol ha-maksik b'machlokas over belav, someone who's maksik b'machlokas, not someone who gets into a squabble, but someone who doesn't let it go. Normal people are going to get into a fight. It's inhuman to never, ever get into a fight with anyone else. That being said, as much as it might be seem inhuman, there's an astounding story about Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was one of the great rabbis of the previous generation, and at his wife's funeral, she died before he did, he got up, and the common practice, the minhag, is to ask mechila from the mace, to ask forgiveness from the the person who just passed, you know, for anything that you would have done during their lifetime. It's kind of that last opportunity. And it's very, very common and oftentimes very heartfelt, and it frequently when, you know, there hasn't been any emotional breakdown within the eulogy, the family member got through it, that's the moment where they break down, which shows the love and concern that they have. But I digress. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, at his wife's funeral, gives the whole eulogy, and at the very end he says, ordinarily we would expect that I would ask you for machila right now, I'd ask you for forgiveness, but I'm not going to do that because I know I never wronged you, because we lived our lives according to the Shulchan Aruch. You and I both lived our lives entirely committed to the direction, to the guidelines of the code of Jewish law, to the Shulchan Aruch, and so I know I never wronged you. And that's it. That was the end. There was nothing more than that. Astoundingly, he felt confident enough to say that. I don't know that I would be able to say the same about anyone, but most people, if you're not Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who had the warmest smile and was a saint of an individual, but still very much a human being, if you're not him, you're not him, you're not his wife, then maybe once in a while we might get into a fight. That's not what we're talking about. If someone gets into a fight that they're not a machzik b'machlokas, someone who gets into a fight and doesn't give up on it, and who is unrelenting, that's really the concern. That's what we're talking about. So that's just what you want to clarify, and that's coming off of this week's parsha. The drasha that the Gemara has is lo yeh kikarach uka adaso. But let's take a look at something a little a bit surprising. The Gemara in Yerushalmi says it's not just that someone who speaks lashon hara, who gets into machlokas, is a bad person, and we don't like them, they're the korach, but the Yerushalmi in Peya says something that you're allowed to speak lashon hara about them, that it's okay to badmouth someone who makes machlokas. That being said, you know, this person clearly is mu'ad, this person's clearly inclined toward machlokas, so it might get you in trouble, but ostensibly it's because this is the kind of person that you want to warn people, don't associate with. Don't be nervous, don't be scared that I can't tell anyone about it, because this person is wicked, this person is going to bring all of us down. So with that note, that framework about how strongly we feel about avoiding disagreements, about avoiding machlokas, let's take a look at a story in Gemara Bava Metzia. We're not going to read the whole thing inside. We're only going to read the end of the story. But the story is as follows. Rabbi Yochanan was the Gadol Dor. Rabbi Yochanan was the biggest rabbi in the generation. He had everything going for him, except he was looking for a kavrusa. And one day he's bathing, and Rabbi Yochanan, the Gemara tells us, was very attractive, and whatever it means to be very attractive at that time. And he's hanging out in the water. Some guy, some bandit, jumps over the river, climbs in, and starts hitting on him. Because he thinks Rabbi Yochanan's a woman. When Rabbi Yochanan turns to him, and the guy finds out that he's in fact hitting on Rabbi Yochanan, he's a little bit embarrassed, but also he says, oh, you're not female. I'm no longer interested. And Rabbi Yochanan says, oh, well, if you came over only because you think I'm attractive, let me introduce you to my sister. She's basically even more attractive than I am. And so the guy's intrigued, and they get into a conversation, and Rabbi Yochanan says, I'll introduce you to my sister on one condition, if you learn Torah with me. And so eventually this individual becomes Shimon, or Shimon ben Lakish, he becomes Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish, as we might be familiar, is the Bar Plugta, the counter-argument to Rabbi Yochanan. Whenever Rabbi Yochanan is arguing, there's a 90% chance, 95% chance, that the person arguing with him will be Reish Lakish. They were best friends, they were chavrusas. The shidduch with his sister worked out, and so they were even brothers-in-law, and they used to fight about everything. They argued non-stop throughout all of Shas. But take a look at this part of the Gemara, because without getting into all the details, you can write dissertations on this part of the Gemara in Bava Metzia, but in Bava Metzia 84a, it says, Nach nafshi de Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish. Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, Reish Lakish dies. The Havakam etzdar Rabbi Yochanan, Basrei Tuva, and he was greatly pained by the loss of his brother, his friend, his chavrusa. Amar Rabbanan, Man lezo leis v'ledaite, who's going to make Rabbi Yochanan feel better? And so you can't replace the brother-in-law, you can't replace the best friend, but at the very least, you can replace the chavrusa. And so they send Rabbi Elazar ben Pedas to Machadadin Shmaisei. He was very sharp. He knew everything. And Gemara tells us, Elazar Yosef Kame, Kol Mitzvah to have Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Amar Lei, Tanya Dimisayei Elacha. Anytime Rabbi Yochanan said something, Rabbi Elazar ben Pedas says, that's a great point. And let me tell you so many proofs, so many supports to what You're sharing to your thought. That's a great point, Rabbi Yochanan. Amar, Akvar Lakisha, Bar Lakisha, Kavahava Mina Nosa, Halamakshile, Asun Va'arba Kushta, Umafarkinan Le, Asun Va'arba Pruke, Umimela Revaka Shmaisa. When I learn with Rabbi Yochanan, and he's sitting there, he's with his new Kavrusa, they're testing it out, and you, this is like any relationship, you know, maybe a business relationship, they're trying to get a sense, is this going to work? And Loza Ben Pedat's complimenting him, Rabbi Yochanan, he's like, I'm not feeling this. My old Kavrusa, Rish Lakish, my dear Rish Lakish, what he used to do, I'll scroll down into the English. When I would say something, he would challenge me. He would attack me. He'd give me 24 kashas, 24 difficulties with what I'm saying. He would constantly say, Yochanan, you're wrong. And what would I have to do? What would I, Rabbi Yochanan, have to do? I'd have to bring 24 proofs in support of my halakha. I would have to bring 24 proofs in support of my opinion. And in that way, the Torah became broad. In that way, the Torah expanded because Rabbi Yochanan was constantly challenging me. You, Elazar ben Pitat, I don't need you to tell me that I'm right. If I didn't think I was right, I wouldn't have said it in the first place. And Rabbi Yochanan basically storms out of the base of Medrash. He goes around, he tears his clothing, and he says, where are you, Rish Lakish? Where are you, Rish Lakish? And include this line in the Gemara, but the end of this Gemara is even more tragic. The end of this Gemara is that Rabbi Yochanan was so distraught after losing his Chavrusa that he dies. Rabbi Yochanan's life comes to an end, not because of subjugation, not because of attacks, not because of even sickness or old age. Rabbi Yochanan dies because he loses his Chavrusa, Rish Lakish. And so our first question is, when we talk about how terrible Machlokas is, someone who's Machzik by Machlokas, if there are proofs to stay in the positive, Rabbi Elazar ben Pedas, who was sharp, was able to defend Rabbi Yochanan each and every time he said something, why does Rabbi Yochanan need to keep pushing, always jabbing, always taking another shot, always pointing out the flaw in the logic when ultimately we're going to Paskin like Rabbi Yochanan? We never Paskin like Rish Lakish instead of Rabbi Yochanan. And so it almost seems that it was just for practice. It was just as an exhibition for Rabbi Yochanan to get these challenges from Rish Lakish. Why did Rabbi Lakish insist on doing so? And why did Rabbi Yochanan so distraught at the loss of this when it wasn't necessary? Rabbi Yochanan was going to pass in the halakha anyway. He was the Gadol Hador. That's question number one. Why such a machlokas? Why do we love machlokas so much in Rabbi Yochanan and Rish Lakish? The second one is the intricacy in halakha. And I remember learning this, actually saw my Rebbe, who taught this to me last night in a wedding. One of the beautiful things about being in New York is that I get to see my Rebbeim from YU. And so I learned this in Elchanan Adler Shir. And actually, no, I take it back. I learned this in Rebbe Daniel Feldman Shir. He was also at the wedding. But anyway, the Gemara in Sanhedrin on Daf 29a tells us, Shnayim Omrim Zakai V'Echad Omer Chayev. We're talking about a Beis Din. And on the Beis Din, traditionally, at least a small Beis Din, has three individuals. One of member of that Beis Din says that the person is chayiv, and two of them say that the individual is zakai, or innocent, if you will. He's exempt. So that's case number one. Two against one, good, bad. Or a second case, what if it's two against one, bad, good? But in both of those cases, what do we do? What is the general rule when it comes to a split in the Beis Din? We split it. And if two against one, whoever is two is going to win. However, there's an oddity in this general law. And take a look at the underline. What happens when you have one person saying chayev, echad omer chayev, ve'echad omer zakai? One person says, yeah, says so the guy's in trouble. The other person says the guy is exempt. Afilu shnayim mezakin or shnayim mechayvin, ve'echad omer eni yodea, yosuvu adayanim. What about that third guy? What happens when you have one guy who's not sure? He doesn't know yes, he doesn't know no, and I say guy because judges traditionally aren't men, but that's just a specific case when it comes to here. We could talk about why they're always men in another context, but we can't do it this evening. I'm happy to explore. Just let me know. I'm happy to discuss it further. But in a case when you have a one-on-one and a third who's unclear, one yes, one no, and a third says, I don't know, then we're at a stalemate. We don't know what to do. But the Gemara adds on. Not just one, we don't make a decision. What happens if I have two people saying yes and one person saying, I don't know? Not no, I don't know. So it's not two against one. It's two against nobody. And the other one is what we call an eni yodea, someone who just says, I don't know what to do. What would we imagine? I'll let you think for a moment because everyone's afraid to talk up, which is understandable. Everyone's on their walks. What would we imagine should be the answer? If it's two against one, chayev pater, we say the person should be chayev. But if it's two against one, two people saying chayev and one person saying I don't know, I would think it should be achar rabim lahatos. We follow the majority, just like we always do. And yet the Gemara tells us yosifu hadayanim. We add on more judges. Why are we adding on more judges? Because we cannot possibly paskin based on just this. I'm going to zoom out a little bit so we can see both the Rashi and the Hebrew. The Rashi here tells us that even two, that why are we adding on dayanim? Afal gav di hava palig alayhu hava batil b'miyuta. If this guy who says, I don't know, said putter or said zakai, instead of saying chayev, there are two chayev and one zakai, two guys saying he's liable and one saying he's not, the guy who says he's not liable is batel, he's nullified, he's kicked out, we follow the majority, because instead of saying the opposite, he's saying, I'm not sure, ki amar eni yodea, hava kimi shelo yashav bedin, it's as if he's not sitting there at all, v'nimsa hadin b'shnayim v'anan tasa ba'inan. And it's as if there was a base din of just two people, not three people, because the person says, I don't know. Why? Why? If we're going to have a majority anyway, there are three dayanim sitting, three judges sitting, and two of them are already making a decision, it doesn't matter what the third person says. And yet, because he says, I don't know, instead of, I know definitively that it's the opposite, it's a stalemate. Everything, we throw up our hands up in the air and say, we got to add in more judges. There's a fascinating and somewhat tragic story about Rav Shimon Shkup. Rav Shimon Shkup was one of the geniuses of Europe. He perished in the Holocaust. But Rav Shimon Shkup was fundraising in the 1940s in the United States, and ended up settling in Yeshiva University area in Washington Heights. And I think he was still fundraising for his yeshiva, but he was also giving shiur in YU because it was too hard for him to get back. And so he was giving shiur in YU for about a year. Now, Shimon Shkup officially is one of Yeshiva University or Ritz's, Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary's, one of their Rosh Yeshiva. And Shimon Shkup was in a car with, I believe, Dr. Belkin. Rav Schechter told the story a couple summers ago during COVID. There was some story time with him to make people feel better, and it definitely made me feel better. It was awesome to listen to. And he's sitting in the car with Dr. Belkin, who's the president of Yeshiva University at the time, and he says, Dr. Belkin, I want to tell you that he references Gemara. He says that my yeshiva and forgetting who else, I mean yeshiva, I guess the board and the rabbinic leadership of my yeshiva want me to come back, and I don't want to go. I want to stay in America. I don't think that there's a future for the Jewish people in Europe. And he said, had I not been sure, if I was in any Odeya, maybe there would be a stalemate, but because I'm positive that I should be staying in the United States instead of going back to Europe, and they're both saying that I should go back to Europe, my opinion is batel, my opinion is overruled by the majority. But Rav Shimon Shkup, in his own way, saw this Gemara as manifesting not just in a court system, but even in his own life, that had he not been positive that America was the place for him to be, then he would have been able to stay. Now, I'm sure that there's more to it than that. I don't know that he was definitively poskening based on this Gemara for his own life, but it's a fascinating story nonetheless. And this is the last story that we're going to try and understand, because we tried to understand why Rabbi Yochanan is so desperate for someone to argue with him, why he seemingly like a glutton for punishment, trying to understand why it's such a necessity within a Beis Din to have people arguing when we have a majority without the argument. And now we're going to see something that might be the most surprising. That's why it's the third question. Gemara in Yerushalmi in Shabbos 1:4 tells us, Elohim ha-halakos she'amru ba'aliyas Hananya ben Chizkiya ben Garon she'alu levakro mimenu. This is the story of the halakos Hananya ben Chizkiya ben Garon teaches us. And when did he learn these laws? When Rabu Beis Shammai al Beis Hillel u'shmonas ha'dvarim gazru bo'ayom. And this is a collection of halakos in Shabbos that we pass in Beis Shammai, because the Beis Shammai had a majority over the Beis Hillel, which we said earlier, we said just now, when there's a majority, we follow the majority, whether it's a Beis Din of three, or whether it's a whole Beis Medrash of rabbis in the times of Chazal, in the times of the Tanaim, there were Beis Shammai against Beis Hillel. And because Beis Shammai had more people than Beis Hillel, seemingly Paskin, like them in those cases. And the Gemara in Yerushalmi tells us, Oso ayom hayakashal Yisrael kiyom shenaasa bo ha'egel. The day that we paskin like Beis Shammai instead of Beis Hillel was difficult for us, like the day that the golden calf was made. Okay, I know that we frequently like paskin like Beis Hillel. On more than one occasion, Beis Hillel is maybe a little bit more lenient, and so maybe we're a little bit happier. We get a little bit more of a freedom if we're passing like Beis Hillel over Beis Shammai. But as bad as the Chet Egel, what in the world is it telling us? Chet Egel feels like a Avodah Zarah. Chet Egel was one of the worst sins the Jewish people have ever committed. What do you mean this is as bad as Chet Egel? So those are our three questions. Why does Rabbi Yochanan love Machlokas? Why is it so hard for him to be without that Chavrusa? Why do we insist that a Beis Din have some kind of Machlokas? And why was the day that Beis Shammai outnumbered Beis Hillel like a day that was worse than Chet Egel? Before we jump into these sources, I want to share an outside story. I guess we'll unshare our screen for a moment. I want to share something separate, something that didn't make it into our source sheets. But there are a lot of exceptional, extraordinary things I gained from joining the YU Torah Mitzvah Kollel. I've since actually officially graduated, but Baruch Hashem, I got to continue learning together because the Kollel wanted a few extra people around. And one thing that I was exposed to that I had not really explored before was podcasts. Now, admittedly, 5 years ago, podcasts were not as popular as they are today. But I've gotten into podcasts since, and they got a lot of great podcasts. We can talk podcasts later on. But one of the ones that really stands out is Adam Grant's podcast. Adam Grant is a professor in Wharton Business School. Adam Grant is a very, very good author, a very good speaker. And he's a psychologist. He's basically an industrial organizational psychologist. And he's got tremendous, Yesodo's tremendous ideas. I'm a big fan, a big follower of his teachings. And he has a podcast called Work Life. And the way one of my friends described it, he's a workaholic, but he figured out a way to make it like a good thing that he's a workaholic instead of, of just working too much. And so Adam Grant, in his opening podcast, his opening episode of Work Life podcast, how to make work not something unpleasant, he talks about feedback. He talked about the importance of feedback and of critiques. And he tells a story and he interviews a guy named Ray Dalio. Ray Dalio is the head of Bridgewater Associates. They have huge returns. At the time, he was getting a return of about 14%. Not every year, most years. If it's every year, it's probably not the most yusher place. But Ray Dalio is now regarded as one of like the leading investment people. I wrote a book called Principles, which actually preceded this podcast. This podcast preceded it. But Ray Dalio is a gavaraba, if you will, in the world of investment. And he talked about it. Talked about his story. He's managing over $150 billion of money, and he's a big deal. So how did he get his start? In 1975, Ray Dalio starts a small investment firm with his friends. He is very successful. He's a bright guy. His friends are bright. And as they're succeeding, as they're doing well, they're getting more and more and more confident, and they're taking bigger risks and getting bigger returns. That's what happens when you take big risks. But at a certain point in time, if you take big enough risks and it doesn't work out, then things fall apart. And Dalio loses all of his money. He has to fire his friends. He has to borrow money from his dad in order to pay his family's bills, in order to pay rent for himself. Forget paying for an office, forget paying for anything beyond. He just doesn't have any money of his own. And so what was his problem? Dalio says of himself that he had no one to tell him he was wrong. He had no one telling him, maybe you should rethink about that again. Maybe this is not the best thing for you to do right now. And because there was no feedback, because there was no one pushing back on him, he said he made a tremendous mistake. And he put himself and his family at risk. Well, we're going to see another source, and then we're going to jump back in a little bit to Dalio's story and to some other interesting things. Uh-huh. Unless, of course, I totally skipped the Rambam. Okay, there's no Rambam here, so we're going to say it outside. The Rambam talks about what it's like to be in a Beis Din. And he says in the Beis Din, in the Supreme Court, if Akilu, not just a regular Beis Din, but the Sanhedrin. Sanhedrin is set up in a funny way. I actually looked into this because someone commented about it to me. In the Supreme Court of the United States, which has been in popular news now a lot, the Chief Justice speaks first, and the Tsar, if you will, the youngest, speaks last. And the idea there is that you get the most experienced, the top, and then gradually trickle down until you get to people with the least amount of experience. The Sanhedrin was set up in the exact opposite way. Fascinating. There were 71 rabbis on this Beis Din, This was, you know, for capital cases. This was for the big decisions that had to be made. And instead of starting from the top, from the biggest rabbis, instead they would start from the bottom. The tzar, the newest person, you know, the young one, who might have less experience and less exposure, and that individual is going to be the one who speaks first, and it goes in ascending order, so that the last person to speak is the one with the most authority, the one with the most experience, the most, one with the most knowledge. Now, why set it up like that? Well, if you have the oldest person speak, the most experienced person speak first, then imagine trying to be the other person. Imagine trying to be the younger guy and sharing a conflicting idea. It's very, very hard. And this actually manifests itself. Malcolm Gladwell talks about it in Outliers in Chapter 7. Outliers is my in-law's house book. Whenever I visit my in-laws, I read a little bit of Outliers. I'm almost done. We'll be there next week, and so God willing, I'll be making a see him on that book. Not a see him, kidding. See him is only something when we finish books of Torah. This is a fun book to read, but I would not call it Torah per se. But anyway, the Gladwell talks about Korean Air, because Korean Air had more crashes than any other airline, and they're trying to figure out what is it, and what they ultimately realized was that it was based off of the Korean culture, because like in a lot of settings, the older pilot was flying the plane, and the younger pilot, the assistant pilot with less experience, was just the assistant, the backup. And the way that Korean culture works is such an air of respect. Even the language that Koreans use when you're talking to a superior is so reverent that the younger pilots, the less experienced assistant pilots, were not willing, not able to speak up when the head pilot, the main pilot, needed to do something differently. And so they bring in psychologists and they change the way the airline's set up. Instead of the main pilots flying the plane, the assistant pilots fly the planes, and the experienced ones instead just kind of stand over the shoulder. I think they're actually sitting next to each other in the cockpit, but they're Kilo standing over the shoulder just correcting them along the way. It's so hard for us to speak up against someone who knows more, who has more experience, who is bigger and better in some ways. But just because you know more, just because you've seen more, doesn't mean that you don't have anything to contribute. You have nothing to share. And so in the Rambam, we want the youngest judge to talk, and in so that he can express himself and not worry about disagreeing with his boss, with his superior, so too with Korean Air. And Ray Dalio has set up his company, has set up Bridgewater Associates in such a way that there's constant feedback that his employees are getting and that he's getting. At one point in time, this I think is hilarious, and I think it was genuine, but if not, it's the best punishment in the entire world. Dalio had an associate, not someone with a lot of experience, the guy probably there for 2 or 3 years, and the guy emails Dalio after a meeting saying, "Ray, I don't feel like you were really prepared for that meeting." And he proceeds to point out to him that you went longer than was planned. You weren't as organized as you were supposed to be, and this and this and this is why. And he says, "I'm only sharing it with you because I know that you appreciate, getting feedback so that you can be better." And Dalio is so enthused by this employee that he had the guy follow him around for a month, go to every one of his meetings to make sure that he was on top of his game. Now, that is a wonderful story about someone being committed to growth. It's also an amazing punishment if you resented the fact that guy told you off. I'm inclined to think, I'm hoping, that Dalio was in the second camp, but you never know. Let's jump back into our source sheet. Now, with that, we have this understanding that we have this yesod, if you will, that getting feedback, hearing a different opinion, is going to create a better court case. It's going to help us fly planes safer. It's going to help us make money if we're in investments. And the Gemara in Tinus on 7a says something so beautiful. It says, "Amar Rabbi Chama, Amar Rabbi Chanina, my dixiv barzel of barzel yachad." That Mishnah talks about iron sharpening on iron. Lomar lecha, my barzel zeh echad mechadid eskavero, af shnei tamin kachamim mechadid zeh behalacha. That just like when you scrape two pieces of iron together, you'll sharpen both of them, they'll sharpen each other, so too when you have two Torah scholars who are studying together, they make each other sharper, they ask questions on each other, and they push each other to be smarter, to be more impressive, to be better, to understand the Torah better. And so let's take a look at the Gemara in Sanhedrin on 42a, because this is a quote from Rabbi Yochanan. It's not Rav Acha bar Chanina says it, but he's quoting Rabbi Yochanan. But mi atam motzim a melchamta shel Torah? Within whom are you going to find a melchamta shel Torah, a battle of Torah? B'mi sheyesh b'yado chavilos shel Mishnah. Someone who knows lots of Mishnah. Someone who really knows what they're talking about. You want to have an expert arguing with you, because I don't need to argue against someone who doesn't know anything. I want to argue against the best of the best. And that, in a lot of ways, is the issue with that Gemara in Yerushalmi. Because why was it such a problem? Why was it like the day of the Chet Egel, when Beis Shammai outnumbered Beis Hillel? Because, without reading it inside, Moshe Feinstein explains in his Truvos that Beis Shammai didn't naturally outnumber them. They cheated. They set up it up that basically Beis Hillel went to lunch, and when it was time to come back, they locked the doors. They didn't let Beis Hillel into the Beis Medrash. And so that day, yes, it's true that Beis Shammai outnumbered Beis Hillel, but not because they genuinely outnumbered them, not because they convinced them that their argument was more legitimate, but that they cheated. They got their way because they prevented the argument from ever happening. And if you're not willing to argue, then that's a very sad day for the Jewish people. But, okay, so you're not willing to argue. Maybe you're chickening out, if we want to be a little crass about it. Maybe you're saying that you didn't do what you were really supposed to do. Why is that like the chet ego? That's a pretty strong statement to make. I wonder if we could suggest the reason why it feels like the day of the chet ego is because the chet ego was maybe not precisely, not exactly, but it was something like avodah zarah. It was something that was inclined toward, that smelled like idolatry. And let's jump down to the last source in order to appreciate this, because I think it actually illustrates it beautifully. I only just clicked in my mind now. I added this source at the very, very end of our source sheet because I had heard it before. It's actually on my mother's cabinet downstairs, but it's something that I remembered recently because the past two weeks, I was in a cohort, I was in a fellowship, I don't know what they call it, but I was in a group of educators learning the Torah of Rabbi Sacks. Yeshiva University, through the Sacks Herrenstein Center, was sponsoring four sessions with Dr. Erica Brown and Dr. Shira Weiss, two exceptional educators, two exceptional scholars, and two people who are really holding in the Torah and the thought and the leadership of Rabbi Sacks. And so we came together and we talked about education. We talked about educational models and how to teach certain methods and ideals. But a lot of times we turned to Rabbi Sacks for that guidance. And so this is one of the quotes that came up last week. I had to include it if we're learning together. Because why does it feel like a avodah zarah in Chet Egel? And why does not engaging in machlokes feel like a avodah zarah? Why did it feel like Beis Shammai was bringing back the Chet Egel? In Dignity of Difference, Rabbi Sacks writes, "The test of faith is whether I can make space for difference. Can I recognize God's image in someone who is not in my image, whose language, faith, ideal are different from mine? If I cannot, then I have made God in my image instead of allowing him to remake me in his." If I'm not willing to engage in my focus, if I'm not willing to hear a counter-argument, then, particularly in the world of Torah and Psak Halacha, it's not just I'm lazy, not just that I'm stubborn, it's that I'm clearly not committed to the truth. I'm clearly not committed to finding out what a Kodesh Baruch Hu wants from me and from us in this world. It's almost like I'm building religion based off of me instead of building religion based off of the Ribbono Shel Olam. Well, what's avodah zarah? Avodah zarah is whenever we have some foreign worship, we're worshiping anything other than God. And avodah zarah might be to a stone, a statue, might be to a wooden statue. It might even be to myself and to my own opinions. And sometimes we get so caught up in our own ideas, what we think must be right, that it smells like Chet Egel. It smells like avodah zarah. And in order to address our second question, why is it in Yodea, the person who says, I don't know, why does that invalidate the court? The Sma tells us that had the other two judges heard a counter-argument, then they might have agreed. But if you never ever hear someone say something different, then there's no opportunity to change. There's no opportunity to be different. It's only if I hear a counter-argument can I really know for sure that my decision makes any sense. And Simon Sinek tweeted so beautifully that when we are closed to ideas, what we hear is criticism, but when we're open to ideas, what we get is advice. Now, that advice is not always met, always presented as I'm looking to help you. Sometimes it's just the opposite. It feels like someone's attacking us, but it doesn't mean that it's still not valuable advice. And we'll close with this source. There's a couple other things on our source sheet, but I think that this is an appropriate place for us to end. The Gemara at the end of Maseches Brachos is actually the end of Brachos and Yevamos and Nida and one other Gemara, which slips my mind at the moment. But we also say no davening on Friday night and on Shabbos morning at the very end of Musaf. Amar Rabbi Lazar, Amar Rabbi Hanina, Tamidich HaKamim, Marbim Shalom Ba'olam, Shinaymar V'chol Banayach Lemudi Hashem, V'rav Shalom Banayach. That Rabbi Lazar says in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, that Torah scholars, Tamidich HaKamim, increase peace in the world. As it says, all your children shall be taught the Torah of the Lord, and shall make peace amongst your children. Do Tamidich HaKamim create peace in the world? I mean, I just know from personal experience that if you walk into a base medrash, a roaring, rocking base medrash, you see people yelling at each other. Rav Schechter tells another story. A lot of stories from Rav Schechter tonight. Rav Schechter tells a story about Galachim, that priests came, cardinals, whatever the specific title was, but representatives of Catholicism came to visit Yeshiva University, because Yeshiva University, thank God, is a very successful institution, but it's a chiddush in the religious world. You have people who are training to be rabbis, or not trained to be rabbis, but who are clearly devout and committed to their faith, but also pushing themselves to be doctors, to be lawyers, to be engineers, people who are going to reach the highest levels of professional achievements in the modern world, in the modern society. The two seem to be in conflict, because in other religions, you don't have that. You have people who are excelling professionally, you have people who are excelling spiritually, but that combination of two is not so common. So Yeshiva University, Dr. Berman talks about this all the time, it's an enigma, and it's beautiful, and so many other faiths turn toward YU trying to figure out what they're doing right. Now, this story will, to some extent, illustrate maybe what YU is doing right. Rav Schechter likes to tell the story. You have these people walking around in the Beis Medrash, in the YU Beis Medrash, and they see these guys arguing. And two guys are arguing. One guy gets up to go to the restroom, and so the priest didn't want to disturb any of the chavrusos, but when this guy's by himself, his chavruso left, they go over to him and say, "Excuse me, young man." And he's very nice, he's a good bentori, he says hello, he introduces himself, he smiles, and they say, "Oh, we want to ask you a question. Why are you yelling at your friend?" And he explained, we're learning the sugya, and he's reading it this way, and I'm reading it that way, and they say, But why are you yelling? He said, "Because this is important to me. And if he's saying something that I don't think is right, I'm going to ask him a question on it." And the priest, like almost instinctually, says, we don't encourage questions." Now, that might have just been that priest. It might have just been that particular religion. But that whole notion of the chavrusa system that exists. Other religions don't have chavrusos the way we have chavrusos. There are lectures. There's public learning that goes on, of course. But Yiddishkeit is built on chavrusos, on having a learning partner, someone who I deliberately, explicitly disagree with and fight with and hassle and haggle with, trying to figure out what is the truth. That's what we're fighting toward. Let's take a look at Rav Kook, because Talmidei Chachamim are arguing all the time. Talmidei Chachamim are constantly yelling at each other. Sometimes if you look at certain chuvos, actually, if you look at the chuvos on abortion, the two biggest rabbis who are talking about it in the modern world are in the modern age, in the late 1900s, some of the language they use is exceptionally strong. It is very, very, very argumentative. I'm not going to get into that this evening, but again, like I said previously, if we want to explore further, let me know, and I'm happy to set it up. At this point, it's public knowledge. We can even record it. And so let's just take a look at what this little piece from Rav Kook. I encourage you to look at the whole piece. This is from his Ein Hayah. Rav Kook was an exceptional genius, and I think he himself even said that he wasn't as much a writer as he was a poet. Sometimes his writing comes out in more conventional prose, but even though it's not really that the case, really everything he said was poetic and it was poetry. He looked at the world in such a way, but it's sometimes challenging to read his stuff. The easiest thing to read is his Ein Hayah. It's his commentary on Maseches Brachos and Shabbos that he wrote when he was 18. And so I guess as an 18-year-old, he was a little bit less poetic, a little bit less less difficult to understand. So let's just take a look at the bottom. We're not even going to read the Hebrew. We're just going to read the English. He says, "Those who are mistaken in thinking that world peace requires everyone to have one thought and one attribute. Therefore, when they see Torah scholars fighting back and forth, people think that it's causing more machloket in the world and not peace. The reality is not so. Real peace can only come through differences of opinion. There'll be an increase in peace when we see all the different perspectives and sides, and we clarify how every person has a place within the truth. Therefore, Torah scholars increase peace in the world because through their extending, explaining, and giving birth to new worlds of wisdom, there's an increase in disagreement, and that increases peace. For the verse says, "And all my children are learned from God, v'chol b'nayach l'mudei Hashem." They all recognize that everyone, even those who think and act entirely differently, are part of the learning of God, and each one has a unique ability to reveal a truth and a deeper understanding of God. In the world today, this week, and basically seeming like every week, there's so many things for us to fight about, so many things for us to argue about, and we're not like Korach because we argue. We're like Korach if we insist on arguing and never give up, and we're like Korach and we're moxic to Machlokas if we allow those arguments to influence how we see someone else. You know, we need to do this last source. I was going to skip it, but it's too important. We have to think about Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai. Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, we know, are the arguers, the people who fight throughout the Gemara. And the Gemara Mesechus Erevin 13b says that for 3 years, Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai argued, and one said halakas like us, the other one said halakas like us. And yet, the Baskel came out and said, Il b'il divrei Elokim chayim. But, halakha ki Beis Hillel. The halakha follows Beis Hillel. Why does halakha follow Beis Hillel? V'chim yakra she'il b'il divrei Elokim chayim, yipnei ma zaku Beis Hillel, yikvol halakha kemosan. If it's the case that all their words are true, why are we following halakha like Beis Hillel? Yipnei she'nochin v'alu v'nhein. Because they still respected the opinion of Beis Shammai. Because they were Noach, they were sweet, they were kind. Because they prefaced the words of Beis Shammai before their own words. That they said, yes, we have an opinion. Yes, we have a thought. But it doesn't mean that we're going to throw away what someone else thinks. I want to understand what someone else thinks. I want to understand what Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai say. Gemara says something even more powerful in Yevamos. The idea of a Yevama is something very intense and extreme in a lot of ways. A yevama, like Daf Yomi is finishing up now, is that if someone has a sister, and we'll use Reuven and Shimon for like the Gemara does, if Reuven's married to a woman and Reuven dies without having a child, then Shimon has a mitzvah to marry Reuven's wife. Okay, that's Yibum. But let's understand for a moment. Reuven and Leah get married, and they're married, they don't have kids yet. But if Shimon and Leah were ever to be together, that is one of the most egregious sins someone could commit. That's one of the arayos. It would be better for Shimon to take a bullet than to ever be with Leah. And yet, once Reuven dies, now there's a mitzvah for Shimon to marry Leah and to have a child with Leah. And so, if a woman is a Yibum or not, has massive ramifications, massive implications, because either it's super usher or a super big mitzvah. So what happens if you have a machlokes, whether or not a woman's a yevama? What happens if we're not sure if there's a mitzvah of yibum? Well, if we're not sure, and you go through with it, you might be violating one of the most egregious sins in the entire Torah. So we would think, okay, so if you're ever not sure, you don't do it. So when there's a machlokes between Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai regarding yevamos, regarding mamzerus, regarding this exact relationship, I would have just said, forget about it. Throw up your hands and say, we're not going to get into it. But instead, what happened? Even though they disagreed about it, and they paskin this way, Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai still had Shabbos meals together. Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai still let their children marry each other. Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai did not allow their differences of opinion, even in these halakos, affect their interactions. There are people that I disagree with tremendously. I have very good friends with whom we constantly disagree about so many things. It doesn't change the fact that they're still my friends. When it comes to values, when it comes to who the person is, I have so much that I can respect, so much that I can care about. I was talking to a friend of mine last night, and he's now working for an organization. He's basically the token Orthodox rabbi in a very not Orthodox setting, in an explicitly not Orthodox setting, and he loves it. And if someone ever asked me to do that, I don't know that I would want to be in a setting where basically, a lot of people are espousing ideas that I disagree with. But he likes it, he enjoys it, and I'm happy for him. And I'm proud of him that he's doing a great job. I think he's much sweeter, he's much more easygoing than I am. He's much less of a kanoi, of a zealot than I am. So I think he's doing great. But even though I disagree with maybe his field of choice, maybe with the way, even the way that he's doing things, we're still good friends. Still give him a huge hug when I saw him and when I left him. And so, just because I disagree with someone about something, why does that mean that we need to become worst enemies? Why can't it be that my best friend is Reish Lakish, the person who challenges me more than anyone else? Because maybe the person who challenges me, the person who pushes me, is the person who cares most about me, not least. And so whether it's in deciding halakha, or whether it's just broadening our mind, if I'm interested in understanding more and understanding further, then I need to find people who disagree. If I don't, then I fall into the Ray Dalio disaster of losing all my money, because all I'm going to do is just bolster my own ideas and never consider the possibility that maybe there's another way to think about this, another way to look at it. Maybe we'll conclude with thoughts. I was visiting the Boca Raton Synagogue, and I'm going to mess this up, and so I'm going to look it up to make sure that I get it right. Boca Raton Synagogue is a wonderful synagogue. It's probably the second best synagogue in the United States, second only to Dachri Noam of Glenbrook. But Boca Raton Synagogue, their tagline, their slogan is "Valuing Diversity, Celebrating Unity." And Rabbi Goldberg is talking to Rav Steinsaltz, who is preparing a cup of coffee on his own, wouldn't let anyone else do it for him. Rav Steinsaltz is preparing this cup of coffee as Rabbi Goldberg is telling him, you know, our theme, our slogan is valuing diversity, celebrating unity. And Rav Steinsaltz goes, well, of course. What do you mean, of course? We spent a lot of time putting this slogan together. And he says, well, if you don't value diversity, then you can't celebrate unity. If there's no diversity, then you have uniformity, not unity. Unity, by definition, means that there's a diversity in your shul, in your community. And so I guess the question I would pose to someone who doesn't necessarily value diversity is, do we also really value unity? Are we not open to someone else saying something we don't agree with, something that we might not like? Because if not, then we're really looking for uniformity. We're not really looking for unity. And so maybe it's worthwhile just to conclude with Rabbi Sachs's line, because no one can say it better than him. But again, that test of faith is whether I can make space for difference. And if I cannot, have I made God in my image instead of allowing him to remake me in his? Thank you so much for learning together tonight. I'm happy to field any questions. But if not, everyone, enjoy your evening. Have a wonderful time in the beautiful weather. Thank you so much for this opportunity. Recording stopped.